Hello, and welcome to episode 77 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, a freelance writer, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. We'll get to my interview with Janos Martin in just a second, but first the news. Well, who am I kidding? There's really only one news story right now, and that's COVID-19. We are well into week two of this crisis, and there's still no clear end in sight. We still have no idea if the wave is cresting and heading back to shore, and it sure seems like it is still building. Jail populations are plummeting across the country, which is great news, while prisons are scrambling to adjust to the risk of the virus. Some departments of corrections are being proactive and transparent, while others seem not to be overly concerned at all about the health and well-being of the people incarcerated inside their prisons. Almost every organization that deals with criminal justice across the country has a plan, and all of us have signed on to a wide variety of letters supporting commutations and decarceration. What is rarely being mentioned at all is that almost all of the measures we have taken to date to reduce the populations of our prisons and jails would have been good public policy with or without COVID-19. For goodness sake, we should always be doing everything we can to ensure that nobody is incarcerated when they are not deemed to be a risk to public safety. Aged and at-risk people in prison should always be allowed to have compassionate releases. People should not be arrested or interned when they are not a risk to public safety. Lack of money should not be a reason people are incarcerated and removed from society and from their families. This should not be a one-off. This should not be about a disease. This should be a wake-up call and proof that incarceration is and always has been a terrible default position to address social problems. We have allowed incarceration to become society's answer to mental illness, to addiction, to poverty, to trauma. We need to now learn the real lesson from this crisis. It is appropriate to err on the side of decarceration. It is appropriate to err on the side of decarceration, and incarceration should never, ever be our default response to our social problems. Can we finally learn what we should always have known? We should always look at incarceration as a failure of imagination, as a policy failure, an inability to come up with a better answer. Now let's get to my interview with Janos Martin. Janos Martin was special counsel to the Moreland Commission to investigate public corruption in New York. Martin was the leader of the Close Rikers campaign, a campaign to shrink the New York City prison population and close its most infamous jail. He was also a national organizer at the American Civil Liberties Union as part of their Smart Justice campaign. Janos is a graduate of Dartmouth College, where he served as a two-time student body president. He earned his law degree from Fordham Law, graduating magna cum laude. He's also only the fourth person to be on the Decarceration Nation podcast twice, which I'm sure is his biggest accomplishment. And he's running for the district attorney of Manhattan, which is my home borough. So welcome back to the podcast, Janos.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
I always start with the same first question, which is how did you get from where you start to where you are now in the work? But since you've answered it once, I was wondering if you had some other kind of things you wanted to talk about your history or how you got to where you are now.
Sure. Well, I definitely have a more thorough answer since more people have asked me that now than the first time I was on. For me, my criminal justice story starts right before college, in a sense. I grew up in Rudy Giuliani's New York in the 1990s, which I know you remember. And that was a time when young people of color were not treated with very much respect by the police. And it was actually coming home from my visit to Dartmouth College. I swiped my student Metro card through the Port Authority turnstiles, and I was grabbed and sort of manhandled by two undercover police officers. And they asked me where I'd stolen the student Metro card from, what was in my duffel bag, and they dumped its contents out into the floor of the Port Authority. And having not found anything, they gave me back a student Metro card without so much as an apology and let me go. And that was a pretty destabilizing experience, and one that I definitely took with me as I went off to college and became an activist and became an organizer around the country, and came back to law school to become a civil rights lawyer and try to work on not only that issue, but all the kinds of issues that I experienced as a young person and saw around me growing up in New York, where people of color were treated differently by our system. So that's a bit of my origin story that I wasn't really sharing as much before I was a candidate because, you know, you like in our professional space, you like to just jump into the professional. But that really is part of what motivated me to take up the career that I have. And I've been working ever since on trying to fight for people's rights, stand up to political corruption, and get people out of jail and prison. And all of those things have led me on this path to running for Manhattan District Attorney now.
And is that, at what point did you kind of realize, okay, now I'm going to run for district attorney? Because you were doing a ton of really great organizing work, which is how I got to know you. And all of a sudden, one day, you kind of emailed me and said, hey, I'm running for district attorney. So how did that happen?
Yes, I'm not. It is not in my high school yearbook that I was going to run for district attorney. That's for sure. I will say that there are a couple steps along the way. I mean, number one, you mentioned it, that part of my bio that I was two-term student body president at Dartmouth, and that is significant only insofar as I was a very active student on student issues, on local issues, even up to the presidential issues, since where I went to school was where the New Hampshire primary took place. So I was a very active young person and had one foot in politics, particularly progressive politics, particularly challenging the Democratic Party establishment for virtually my entire adult life. Over the course of my legal career, I certainly was attuned to what an important role district attorneys play in the criminal justice system. And working for the ACLU, I got to go around the country and see what a difference it made in places like St. Louis and Philadelphia and Chicago to have reform-minded candidates defeat longtime incumbents or local political machines that had defaulted to a sort of law and order, tough on crime approach to criminal justice. And so I knew that it made a difference to have a progressive district attorney. But I didn't really start thinking about myself in that capacity until I started working on the Queens district attorney race. I was a very early supporter of Tiffany Caban. I'm actually on her first palm card. During that race, I was going to support her just based on ideology, on the fact that I supported her values and her mission. But it was fascinating to see over the course of the race that New Yorkers actually had a pretty big appetite for transforming the criminal justice system, which is not something that anybody who worked in New York politics really could say one way or the other before Tiffany's race. And so, over the course of the Queens DA race, I realized that somebody who had my values and my politics could actually run for Manhattan DA, defeat Cy Vance, transform the Manhattan DA's office, and take it in a whole new direction. So that's sort of the evolution of my thinking on this. I've always recognized that politics has to be part of how we enact change. It's really a combination of organizing and politics and legal fights. But all those things really just came together for me in the last couple of years, and I made the decision to run, in the early summer of last year.
So we probably should start with the crisis everyone is dealing with right now. Almost all of us across the country are stuck in our houses as a result of policies to enhance social distancing. Glenn Martin suggested in an article yesterday that people who have served time are often searching for ways to rejoin society, but in some ways society has now joined us. That really resonated with me, and I certainly remember being in this exact same room I'm sitting in right now 24 hours a day every weekend for 2 years when I was on parole and probation. How has social distancing been for you and your friends and family so far?
Well, thanks for checking in on that. First of all, I should say I hope that you and folks close to you are healthy and safe and able to practice social distancing. We know that's the right thing for people to be doing right now. But we also know that not everybody has that opportunity. And I'm sure we're going to get to talking about folks in jail and prison momentarily. For me, I'm doing perfectly fine. I've always been able to work from home and mentally doing fine. The people around me are all safe and healthy. I've been carrying a fair amount of anxiety, knowing what I know about not only our jail and prison system here, but also our shelter system and our public housing system. From everything that I understand about the coronavirus, those are all places where there's strong possibilities of outbreaks happening. And nothing from what I've seen has led me to believe that our local government is prepared for outbreaks in jail, prison, shelters, or public housing. So, you know, day to day, I have a fair amount of anxiety that it's going to start happening soon. And it's particularly frustrating because when it comes to our jail and prison system in particular, I've been raising my voice as loudly as one can in the digital space, along with a lot of great activists, trying to get the mayor and the governor to get ahead of this issue. And they absolutely have not. So again, personally,
yeah, they really haven't.
So personally, I'm doing just fine, but you know, I'm pretty nervous for the next few weeks ahead. You know, for your listeners who are not from New York City, we have something like 30,000 cases in New York State. The majority of those are in New York City. You know, we have a significant number of people dying every day now. This is no longer the warm-up or the dress rehearsal. This is happening in real time now. I'm starting to hear somewhat horrific stories of what's happening at the hospitals, both from my friends who work in the medical field and as well as people who have lost loved ones. I'm fortunate to not have lost anybody personally close to me, but I'm a degree of separation away from that right now in New York. So we're very much in the middle of it right now.
So I know I've been pushing pretty much since the start of this thing for people to stop making arrests, for people to stop putting people in jail for things that really people don't need to be in jail for, and to let out as many people as they can. A lot of people, I think, wonder why we are all pushing for decarceration in response to COVID-19. Why do you think decarceration is so important right now?
There are so many reasons. I mean, number one, you know, jail and prison should not be a death sentence. And the fact that there are people who are, let's start with the vulnerable populations, right? There are people who we know, everybody knows, are medically at risk. If they catch the coronavirus, they need to be attended to quickly and with top medical care. People who are, you know, above the age of 60, and as you know, people who are in prison and have been in prison for a long time often have underlying health issues. So the 60-year cutoff is not really adequate to describe people who have been living in prison for a long time. That number is actually probably much lower. So you have people in jail and prison who are just simply vulnerable, and those people absolutely need to be released. There in New York, we have clemency, but it is barely used, and there are hundreds of clemency applications sitting on the governor's desk right now. And what I've been pushing for is to start there. All you got to do is sign it. These people have already done the paperwork and everything. I think beyond people who have formal clemency applications, you also need to create a temporary medical furlough program that can reach a much broader constituency of older people serving time in prison right now. We don't have such a system in New York under law, but under the emergency powers that were granted to the governor, he's very much within his right to set up such a program. So there's no legal obstacle there. So that's the moral issue of people who are particularly vulnerable who need to get out. Now, obviously, this virus will hit all of us, right? And so even if you're not above the age of 60, we need to be practicing social distancing. We need to make sure that people are being tested. We need to make sure that people who are sick are not living next to and on top of people who are not sick. So that means that we have to reduce the number of contacts that police have with the community. We need to, you know, end arraignment practices that risk spreading the virus. We need to make sure there are fewer people in jail. We need to make sure that unnecessary meetings, like things like technical parole violation hearings, are being suspended. And, you know, all of this, you know, we've been pushing for all of these things, and some have happened and some have not. But to me, you know, even if you don't have a single bit of compassion for people who are incarcerated, like you don't care about folks in jail or prison at all, the reality is that the virus doesn't discriminate between somebody who's incarcerated and somebody who works in the jail and prison system. And those are the folks who are going in and out every day. And they're going to be carrying that home to their families. Yesterday on Twitter, I posted something that a friend's relative shared with me. He is a cook on Rikers Island. He is required to go into work. He's not allowed to take off more than 2 days, including sick days, because he's deemed as essential personnel. And he's terrified because he's almost certainly going to catch the coronavirus at some point. And he lives with his mother and his elderly grandmother, and he doesn't want to bring the coronavirus home to them. And so this is not just about the people who are incarcerated, although I would be perfectly fine to start there. This is also about the fact that we're trying to contain a disease, and it's going to affect everybody if we don't get it under control.
To take it even more in a more specific direction, Dr. Ross McDonald said this on Twitter about COVID-19 recently in regards to Rikers. We cannot change the fundamental nature of jail. We cannot socially distance dozens of elderly men living in a dorm, sharing a bathroom. Think of a cruise ship recklessly boarding more passengers every day. A storm is coming, and I know that I'll be doing when it claims my first patient. What will you be doing? What will you have done? We have told you who is at risk. Please let as many out as you possibly can. We already know Rikers was in many ways a public health and human rights disaster before COVID-19. So will you share where you think we're at now?
Yeah, well, that's very eloquent from Ross. And I have to say all of the medical staff who work at Rikers historically have been really fierce advocates for the people that they serve there. And, some of the people who used to work in corrections, such as John Giftos, who a lot of people follow on Twitter, have always spoken up about the egregious conditions that they have to work under and how unjust and inhumane jail and prison is. I mean, I think, frankly, this has been an eye-opening process for some people who don't, like us, work in criminal justice reform, just to show how awful the jail and prison system is. You know, we actually, during the Close Rikers campaign, when we were starting the Close Rikers campaign, part of the purpose of that effort was to reshape New Yorkers' understanding of what Rikers Island is, what's wrong with it, who's on it, why are they there, to dispel a lot of myths, which, you know, the prevailing myth before 2016 is that everybody on Rikers Island is extremely dangerous criminal who needs to be put away. And that's sort of the imagery that you would get from Law and Order and movies. And so we had to really reintroduce Rikers Island to people. And one of the tacks that we took was explaining that it was such a public health hazard. I mean, it's always been a place that is deeply unhealthy. Outbreaks have affected the island in the past. The corrections department has resorted to sending people to solitary if they get sick under those conditions. So none of this is new with COVID-19. But I have to be honest, you know, of all the different angles we use to talk about the inhumanity and injustice of Rikers Island, the public health angle never really took off. And I think, you know, it's just not an issue that most Americans really ever thought much about until COVID-19. So, you know, the situation there now is quite dire. From our understanding, you know, it's reached that exponential infection rate where it's gone from, you know, a handful of people to 20 to 70 to I don't know what today's numbers are, but it's really climbing fast. De Blasio is finally moving to take people off the island, and the number of people on Rikers, we're being told, is now the lowest number. It's just dipped below 5,000, which is the lowest number since the 1940s. So if I can put like a half full thing on this, Josh, you know, part of what I'm hoping for is that if we can release aging people from prison, if we can release people who are on technical parole violations from jail, if we can take everybody who is, quote, doesn't pose a risk, but, you know, whatever that happens to mean to the mayor and to the Department of Corrections, and really shrink the jail population and shrink our prison populations because of COVID-19, my hope is that when the dust settles from this, we'll recognize as a society that those people never needed to be locked up in the first place, and maybe this shrinkage should become the new normal, and we should keep moving to push numbers down. So, you know, my hope is that everybody who's taken off of Rikers Island in the name of public health and safety today never goes back.
So I have to take a second here to ask, I mean, you talked about this a little bit before, and you just mentioned that Mayor de Blasio is finally starting to move to some extent on this problem. But, you know, and you talked about how New York is a lot more progressive on this issue than people would expect. But at the same time, it seems like Governor Cuomo, Mayor de Blasio, and Cy Vance have not been exactly super proactive. Can you kind of explain this distance between that kind of Democratic politics and the kind of progressive politics you're talking about or you're bringing to this race?
Absolutely. You know, New York is both at the city and state level, essentially a one-party town at this point. And it, you know, has been for a lot of its history, Democrats have been the dominant party here. And what that means is that you have a lot of Democrats who are not, you know, progressive, liberal, social justice oriented, whatever set of synonyms you would use to describe the kind of people that really fight for working people, fight for low-income communities of color, fight for marginalized communities. So, you know, Governor Cuomo has really spent his three terms as governor as a proud centrist, somebody who, you know, is often quick to sort of scornfully reject progressive proposals. And when it comes to criminal justice, he has not generally been a leader on the issue. And only after a large amount of advocacy, he may come around to a position like, you know, medical marijuana or raise the age. That's what made bail reform's passage last year so interesting, is that Cuomo had dithered on bail reform for years. And a Democratic state Senate that was emboldened by large new majorities really pushed it onto his desk and forced him to take action. So, you know, when you look at who Governor Cuomo is, he has never been a leader in criminal justice. And I have actually a personal theory as to why he's not acted here. You mentioned the Moreland Commission while introducing me. For those who don't know it, the Moreland Commission was an anti-corruption commission that was meant to investigate lobbying, illicit lobbying and election practices. And I served on it as special counsel. And it was actually investigating Governor Cuomo that led to Cuomo freaking out and shutting down the entire commission. It was my first sort of 15 minutes of fame as a young lawyer. And I will say that my experience working with Governor Cuomo is that he's a micromanager. He is really focused on specific projects. He really gets deep into them. And if you're not in that tunnel vision of what he's trying to get done, things just aren't going to get done. That's how the state government works. And so my sense is, you know, he's focused on these ventilators. He's focused on hospital beds. And he just does not care about people who are in prison right now. That is just not his focus, not his interest. He's not going to delegate it. And it's been really frustrating, exasperating to watch that. Now, Mayor de Blasio himself, he's in more of like a pressure cooker of New York City, being held accountable by journalists and local activists and council members. So he's sort of been forced to act. But you know what I'm hearing through the grapevine, through my contacts in the city council and in media, is that, I mean, the slowness of this Rikers thing, of not responding quickly, that is at Mayor de Blasio's feet. He's getting enormous pushback from groups like the NYPD to not do it, and that's part of why he moves so slowly. And then with DA Cy Vance, I mean, come on, this is just par for the course. DA Vance loves calling himself a reformer, but you know, he hasn't been out in the front on any issue in many years. And in this case too, he signed his name to a letter saying that he needed to respond to COVID-19, you know, by releasing people from jail. But we're talking negligible numbers of defendants have been released from Rikers. And we know that, you know, if the New York City DAs, I mean, all five of them should be held accountable on this. But, you know, Vance has been no hero in this situation either.
So what should be done? You, I believe, released a plan to decarcerate New York City by 80% well before this all happened, correct?
Yeah, Manhattan to be specific, only because as Manhattan DA, that would be the, you know, my jurisdiction.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I would love to decarcerate all the country by 80%, but that was outside my powers.
Yeah, that was sloppy writing by me. Sorry about that.
No, all good. You know, so yes, 80% is a number that we came up with basically to do a couple things. Number one, the ACLU, at the Smart Justice Campaign, we worked on issues all over the country, bail, sentencing, parole, and DA accountability. And we found that if a DA tells you, or a DA candidate or tells you he's for reform, that he's going to end mass incarceration, that he's going to reform the criminal justice system, it behooves you to make that DA or DA candidate put a percentage on how much they're going to decarcerate. Because as we know, the criminal justice system is so convoluted and so full of whack-a-moles that, you know, somebody can actually follow through on changing a policy, but then another policy prevents people from actually getting released. And next thing you know, the number of people in jail hasn't changed at all. So getting people to agree to a percentage was a tactic that we used to hold people accountable. So in a sense, this is me holding myself accountable and putting myself out there and saying, I have an actual commitment to reducing getting this many people out of jail. And so when I made that announcement, there were about 3,000 Manhattan defendants in our jail system. So that would bring the number down to about 600 and 500 or so. And the reason that we chose that number range is because if you just look at the severity of charge, which is an imprecise, as you know, measure of who did what, but it's at least approximate. We have solutions currently in our system that we just need to scale up of how we can take a whole variety of misdemeanors, nonviolent felonies, and even some violent felonies, and really work with people outside of the jail system to get them the help they need, to get them back on their feet, to stop the cycle of harm from happening. Whereas there is a narrower band of very serious offenses that we have not yet figured out how to solve. And I want to be quite clear, I don't think jail prison is the answer. I don't think that will solve those cycles of harm from stopping. But at present, we just don't know what to do instead with somebody who's been accused of a crime like murder or something. So that's where I came up with the number 80%. I'm the only candidate in the crowd race to have made such a declaration. And for the 1% of listeners who, you know, get into the wonky weeds, you can actually read 15 pages of how we propose to get there and what type of programs that we support and all of that. So we really try to show our work and show leadership, and not just using catchphrases, but actually talking about how we're going to decarcerate when we're in office.
So when you do something like that, obviously, I'll talk a little bit about this more later, but, you know, there's a lot of tough on crime, police, a lot of the press in New York City that are going to say, well, you know, why would you put New York City at risk by decarcerating? Do you have anything you want to say about that?
Oh, absolutely. Trust me, now that I'm a candidate, I don't have to wait for the articles. I meet folks like that every day. And and we have really honest conversations. You know, I sat down with a group of mothers who are very concerned about rises in crime in their neighborhood. And they came into it being candid that, look, we're liberal, moderate Democrats, but we are very concerned about the rise in crime. We think bail reform is the reason for it, and we want something to be done. Not in 5 years with your, you know, invest community resources and housing and schools, but we want something done now. And I think that's actually a perfectly acceptable response for them to have. They're the ones raising kids in the neighborhood now. They want to know what will be done to make their neighborhood safe tomorrow or really next year, right? Because I'm not, you know, elected yet. And I want to honor that that tension, that frustration. My response is you can actually trace a lot of what constitutes crime back to very specific issues that people are dealing with. It might be economic desperation. It might be a mental health issue. It might be, related to a person's substance use, either manifesting in behavior that they wouldn't normally do or petty larceny to pay for the habit that they're trying to, that they're addicted to. So if you look at those underlying crime, we can either solve them by locking somebody up for 60 days or 6 months or 2 years, right? Most of the crime that flows through our criminal court system is at this lower level. And we can say, okay, we'll lock a person away for 60 days because they assaulted somebody on the street. And then hope that they are totally fine when they come back and they won't do it ever again. Or we can say, what happened here? Why did this harm take place? What can we do to stop it in the future? And if the answer is something other than jail or prison, then let's actually invest resources in that. So that's my position that I talk to people who have public safety concerns about. And I think there's a real difference between people who have good faith public safety concerns, like the group of mothers I spoke with, and people who are political and reactionary, like the tabloid newspapers in New York or law enforcement unions. And my response to them would be largely to ignore them at the moment. But at the end of the day, the way I'm going to implement all of this is really working with rank and file police and make it clear to them that this is going to make their jobs better in the long run too, because what we're trying to do is, again, break these cycles of harm so that you're not dealing with that same guy for the 10th time and arresting him for the 10th time, bringing him to the precinct while he's sort of, you know, struggling in your handcuffs. Like, why is that good for you? You know? So I do feel like when I get the chance to sit down with rank and file police and talk them through this, we're going to have more conversations, or at least more people willing to try it out than one might think. But there are certainly elements of our reactionary right-wing politics that are never going to come around. And there's no sense in pretending they will.
Another proposal that you came up with was one to end the use of solitary confinement. Could you talk both about that proposal, but then also, I think it's important in this current crisis, to relate it back to COVID-19? And why I say that is because a lot of times the way prisons and jails treat is a weird word to use there, someone who's infected is to segregate them. And the way they do that is usually to put them, in essence, in solitary for being sick. So if you could kind of talk about both of those, that would be great.
Absolutely. Early in the Close Rikers campaign, the position of the mayor's office in New York was that Rikers didn't need to be closed. It could just be reformed. And we, the leadership of the campaign, were invited to tour Rikers Island. It was in sort of an all-access, behind-the-scenes look at the amazing work the administration was doing. And the purpose of the tour was to show us that because of all these programs and reforms they had in place, we should really just give up on our idea of closing Rikers and settle for reforming it. And one of the places that we were taken to was the Enhanced Segregation Unit, where people were spending between 20 and 23 hours a day in their cells in solitary. And I asked if I could go around and talk to folks, and our handlers said, sure. And it was really quite a jarring experience. Now, I'm somebody who has been arrested. I've been in jail, you know, for a day or two at a time. I visited people in prison. So I'm not squeamish about this stuff. But looking into the solitary cells was jarring for me. You know, the way to look in was the size of a, you know, small porthole that you'd imagine a boat. And inside there was just such a cramped, confined space with this searing light. You know, no place really to move around. The acoustics were all very disorienting. And there were some people who were more than happy to talk to me. Some of them had not had real communication with folks for a while. And I just couldn't understand how we could morally allow this to happen. It's just so inhumane that when I started reading up on what the different policies were around it, the Mandela laws, you know, as recommended by the United Nations, say that more than 15 days in solitary is considered torture. I thought 15 days, that sounds way too long.
I personally was only in solitary for about 3 total days, and it seemed like torture to me. So.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think I would start to really lose it after more hours than you can sleep, right? Like 10 or 12 hours. And then, you know, a couple of days for sure. 15 days just sounds totally inhumane. And at the moment, you know, there's legislative fights to change the policy at the state level and local fights to change at the local level. But at the moment, you can still be in a Rikers solitary cell for up to 30 days and longer in some cases in New York State prison. And so seeing all those fights go down and seeing the advocates fall just short, which was disappointing for all of us, I put out my position, which is as Manhattan District Attorney, I will not prosecute anybody who's being tortured in solitary. Now, this is actually a pretty straightforward policy position. Given that it would usually take some number of days to learn via the family or via the lawyer that a person is being held in solitary, if I find out that somebody who's a defendant in front of us is in solitary confinement, I will tell Department of Corrections and the mayor's office and whoever else needs to be involved politically that if that person is not removed from solitary, we will drop the case. And, you know, as if the back and forth drags on by the 15-day mark, we will follow the UN protocols and officially drop the case by day 15 if the person is not released by then. And that will be, in a sense, a game of chicken politically. I'm fully aware of that. That might require dropping a case against somebody who's done something pretty serious. But the way I explain it in my policy paper, which people can read at JanosForDA.com, is that to me, the law needs to have legitimacy. And in so many communities that have been over-policed for so long, the law already lacks legitimacy. And I, as an attorney, am not going to proceed in prosecuting somebody, potentially putting somebody away for months or years at a time in our prison system, if the defendant on the other end of the table is being actively tortured in the process. To me, that just completely lacks legitimacy as a legal system. So that's how I've taken my position. Hopefully my position is not necessary because advocates get everything that they're fighting for at the local and state level. But you know, I talk about how I would enact that position. And connecting it back to COVID-19, we actually put it out as COVID-19 was breaking. And definitely what you brought up about the connection between outbreaks and solitary confinement is 100% true in jails and prisons all across the country where sick people are segregated in solitary. To me, that is just unacceptable. If you need to remove somebody from general population incarceration for whatever reason, either because they had a fight or because they're sick or anything in between, there's logical reasons why somebody has to be removed from general population. That doesn't mean that the answer has to be a tiny metal box with no connection to the outside world. And so, especially when a person's sick and anxious, and in the case of coronavirus, probably experiencing shortness of breath, I mean, it's just the worst of all worlds to take somebody who's experiencing the symptoms of COVID-19 and putting them in a small, cramped space where they'll have great difficulty reaching people.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on that. So, you know, we talked about this for just a second before, but we had this huge, I think hugely important moment where bail reform passed in January in New York City, and I think symbolically important across the country. And then almost immediately there was a backlash, and it was a pretty coordinated backlash. And now we've seen a lot of backsliding. Where are we at on bail reform right now in New York City?
Oh, well, I'm not sure when this podcast is going to go up because we are days away from finding out where the governor is going to wind up on this and whether the assembly speaker is going to hold his ground and defend the bail reform that he and his members fought for last year. So just to zoom out for a second for people who didn't see the fight that unfolded over the last couple of years, bail reform has been a topic that advocates have gone to bat for years. It's picked up steam increasingly in 2016, 2017, fell short in 2018. In 2018, Democrats took the state Senate from Republicans who had previously bottled up all criminal justice system for years. And there was a flurry of things that passed in 2019 in all different issues. And on the criminal justice side, the trifecta of bail reform, discovery reform, and speedy trial all got passed and were signed into law. So there was a nine-month period between when the law passed and when it was going to be implemented. And that's part of what the problem was, is that for 9 months, this reactionary triangle of the state Republicans, law enforcement unions, and the New York Post in particular, all the other publications as well, basically had time to gear up their attack machine and really start scaring New Yorkers about what bail reform would mean. It was a multi-step process. First, they scared New Yorkers and said, because of bail reform's passage, this is going to happen to you. And then starting, actually, even before the implementation, they started these attacks in December for a bill that took effect on January 1st. Starting in December, if a person was released pre-trial and did something heinous, they'd say, well, look, this is what you get by putting all those libs in charge of bail reform. And it was a very well-coordinated, sophisticated, well-done attack. You know, these reactionary forces amplified each other over and over. And it worked. I hate to say it, but it worked in that it scared a lot of moderate folks and white liberals into thinking that this bail reform was, in fact, endangering our community when, you know, nothing could be further from the truth. And it's been hard to message against it in a way that's been rapid response and coherent. So where we are.
And I sure tried from afar.
Yeah. Well, I say the part of the storyline that that I found very effective when I speak in front of groups of people who don't know very much about the issue is I say, yes, you saw that story in the New York Post about the fellow who was released pre-trial and got caught for something else. But did you know that 1,500, 2,000, 3,000, I mean, these numbers are going up, obviously, of people are out of jail and at home with their families and fighting their cases from home because of bail reform. And when people realize what a success bail reform was in that respect, it wins over a lot of those people that we actually won over the first time. You know, it's been a bit of a seesaw. So I think Carl Hastie, the Speaker of the Assembly, acknowledges that. I think there's also something that's very bad government of trying to amend a law weeks into its implementation as opposed to just letting it run its course for, say, 6 months or a year to see what actually happens with it. So we don't know in the showdown between the Speaker and the governor what's going to happen. The governor has repeatedly said he's going to change the bail law. And just to, you know, because I know people are pretty well-versed in criminal justice policy, it's an excellent law. It says that people will be released on their own recognizance if they're charged with misdemeanors or nonviolent felonies. Not all nonviolent felonies, but most of them. And, you know, for other offenses like violent felonies, those cases are bail eligible, which does not require, obviously, that bail be set, but Prosecutors often ask for bail in those cases, and judges are happy to set them. You know, there is an increased use of supervised release. Some of the supervised release programs are up and running, some are not. So that's where the law is right now. I think it's one of the strongest laws in the country, and it'd be a huge shame for it to be rolled back. And it would just be a very disappointing cave by Governor Cuomo. But we'll know a lot more in about a week.
As I've kind of gone across the country, a lot of the feeling I've gotten from other states and from leaders I know around the country is that there's a sort of feeling that this might have been a moment where the empire started to strike back and people are actually worried. I feel like people might be taking the wrong lessons from this backlash against bail reform in New York City and in New York State. What do you think the rest of the country could learn from this battle that might move us back in the right direction? Because we'd kind of been moving toward reform pretty universally across the country prior to this.
Absolutely. It's been very disappointing to hear certain legislators say things like, we've got criminal justice fatigue here in Albany. It's like, settle down, guys. You passed some pre-trial bills. We haven't done anything about parole, anything about seeing, anything about solitary confinement. So you can't get criminal justice fatigue from one or two bills. But I hear it. I hear that, you know, there's a period as when you as an advocate where you have it focused on your issue, and then people moved on, and that can be really challenging. That's sort of why when I designed the advocacy campaigns that I did, whether it's Closed Records or Closed the Workhouse in St. Louis or the work I did for the ACLU Smart Justice campaign, I always tell folks that you have to have a sense of urgency around your campaign, because criminal justice might be the it issue today, but it could be unemployment, economic issues tomorrow, especially given what's happening with COVID-19. It could be housing. It could be climate change is where all the activists gravitate. So you never know how long people are actually going to pay attention to your issues. So I think always campaigns have to be designed with maximum urgency. Get it done now. As far as what I would lessons to take from bail reform, there are a couple. One is really have an operation in place to celebrate the positive outcomes of the reforms that you're implementing. You know, personal stories, numbers, lifting up the champions of those bills, and just showing what good comes from this. I mean, we have the lowest New York City jail population that we've had in many, many decades. And that's in part because of bail reform. That's a really great thing to be proud of. Frankly, de Blasio should be all over, clutching that as an example of what a great mayor he is, right? But that's not how it's shaken out. So that's one thing. Number two, we said this at the time, but inherently, if you are releasing people pre-trial who under our classic criminal justice system would have wound up in jail, that's an encashment that includes a lot of people who have challenges, right? People who have housing issues, who have substance use issues, who may have repeated contact with police, either because of what they do or because the police don't like them or for whatever reason. So if you pass something like bail reform and put no thought or resources behind how you're going to help those people, then you're going to get your more New York Post stories. Right? And I think some of us wish there had been slightly more attention on the sort of reentry is almost the wrong word, not being sent to jail, right? But more resources into direct services for people who come into contact with the criminal court system to make sure that they do get back on their feet and don't wind up, in the crosshairs of the New York Post.
I think it's like deflection programs.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even like, in New York, have a growing affordable housing crisis where there's more people in transition housing who can't get regular housing. So there are fewer slots in transition housing for people who are homeless. And this all backs up. And if you don't even have, if you sort of cycle in and out of a criminal courtroom and you have no access to resources and you're not being helped by a caseworker, this is something that we could have solved for. We certainly have the money and resources in New York to have figured this out in a little bit more sophisticated manner than we did.
That makes a lot of sense. We've discussed decarceration a lot already, but this season I'm asking people to give us some new ideas for decarceration. I don't know if there's a new idea, but I saw you also have a plan for stopping long and indeterminate sentences. Is that correct?
I do. I can talk about that, but I can also talk about a drug policy, which I think is pretty interesting. But, you know.
Your choice.
Sure. Well, because I don't think this is, I will give full credit to the end life sentences folks, because at the Sentencing Project and their allies, I've become, as far as I know, the first district attorney candidate in the country to call for 20-year caps on prison sentences. And that would apply to all offenses with very limited exceptions for, you know, that sort of once-in-a-lifetime infamous crime or for acts of terrorism, which carry mandatory life sentences in New York. But generally, this would be a 20-year cap on all sentences. And I think, as all the folks at the Sentencing Project and elsewhere have pointed out, doing this would not only prevent what we have now, which is people serving, you know, getting old and dying in prison, even though they pose no public safety threat, but it would also right-size the rest of the sentencing system. We'd have a lot fewer stray 10-year, 15-year sentences being casually handed out if the maximum was 20. So I think it would do a lot to just bring the whole sentencing system into proportion. So let me talk about the drug policy issue though, because I find the issue that got me into working on criminal justice. I spoke about how I was stopped and frisked as a teenager, and I was arrested as a teenager. But what got me into activism, actually trying to do something about this stuff, was Students for Sensible Drug Policy. It was my first organizational home as a 17-year-old, and drug policy has always been top of mind for me. I think the war on drugs is one of the most intuitively bad ideas in our national history, right? It was easy enough for me as a teenager to see how ill-founded it was. And I feel the exact same way as I did 20 years ago. What I proposed for ending the drug war in New York comes with some of the proposals that are becoming hopefully more mainstream among progressive DA candidates, which is declining to prosecute marijuana cases and not prosecuting people for low possession cases for other substances. But I also want to point out from my personal experience, not only of people I know from growing up, but also from people who I've represented in court, that people who sell drugs don't really have an off-ramp currently the way we handle the war on drugs. Either we prosecute people who are sellers, we use that dichotomy like users, not sellers, or we say, well, the reason they're selling is because they're addicted, so if we get people into programs for treatment, then maybe they can stop selling, which is good. There are some people who fit that category. But just as many people, if not way more folks, sell because that is the economic choice that they've been offered because of where they've grown up, because of the local economy, because of lack of investment from the government and from the private sector. And I think it's irresponsible to think that the only solution we have for an entrepreneurial 20-year-old who's dealing drugs is to either put him in prison or mandate him to a treatment program when he's not addicted to anything. So I proposed having a diversion program specifically for people who are selling drugs that focuses on their economic path to self-reliance in the legal economy and partnering with the many successful private companies. We have just a few successful private companies here in New York, and seeing if they can take in some of these folks and give them real, meaningful economic programs and opportunities to choose a different approach. So we put that out in January, and we've gotten good feedback on it so far. So that's part of what we're doing in this campaign, is just having honest conversation. It's easy enough to say that we won't prosecute low-level marijuana cases. It's even easy to say that we're going to focus on treatment for people who have addiction issues. But the reality is that a lot of people sell because they're trying to put food on the table. They're trying to make money for their family in an expensive city. And if we're not honest about that, then the practice is never going to stop. And, you know, going around talking to people in public housing in East Harlem and the Lower East Side and Washington Heights, people don't want drug selling happening in their lobbies or in their streets. But we have to give different economic opportunities to the people doing it if we really want it to stop.
Another question I've been asking people this season is about breaking the binary, the supposed binary between people who are victims been survivors of crime and people who have been incarcerated. How do you think we start to bridge kind of this hard and fast rule that considers survivors of crime on one side of the line and people who've been sentenced for crimes on the other side of the line as naturally opposed?
Here's how I would break that down. Right now, victims of crime are not being taken care of in the criminal justice system. And that's where I start this conversation. I could definitely go into the work other people have done, talking about how very often victims of crime and people who commit harm are from the same communities and are the same people. I think you've had other guests talk about that angle really eloquently. But my experience running for this position has put me into contact with a lot of survivors of crime who tell a story that I don't think gets shared enough, which is the deeply unpleasant experience that survivors and victims of crime have dealing with district attorney's offices and the police. So you know, we always think of it as that this, right? On the one hand, you know, DA is saying, you know, we're doing this for the victims. That's why you are, you know, you guys are coddling criminals. We're here for the victims. That's just not the experience that victims are having in our system right now. The experience they're having is deeply unfriendly, sometimes hostile police and district attorney interactions when they report their crimes, depending on who they're accusing and what the crime is, being kept totally in the dark on the case, being very callously sort of traded around the office to different people who need them at different points in the case. And so by the end of this, this is not justice for them. They want this to be over. And it is a broken system. And it's most broken in the sex crimes unit in Manhattan, where from my conversations with a lot of women, including women of some privilege, is that a well-connected defense lawyer can definitely trump whatever sort of complaints they're going to bear in a high-profile case. And so very often you have a woman of privilege who's complaining about sexual assault. Her assaulter is also somebody who comes from privilege too and may have more resources than her. So I think that those stories to me, as well as other stories I've heard, just have reminded me that we don't really have a for anybody. And it has to start, we have to fix this by with some procedural justice. We've spoken a lot on this podcast about substantive justice, right? How can we come up with different ways other than jail and prison to stop the cycle of harm? But the procedural justice matters too. Who is listening to you? How are you being treated? What are your needs at this moment as a victim of crime? That stuff is just not happening right now. And just as I would want to treat every person who's accused of a crime as an individual, and how can we get this person back on their feet? How can we stop the cycle of harm from happening? I would feel the same way about the victims. What does this victim need right now? What is, in this moment and going forward? And so I know that's not exactly the question you asked, but that's sort of what's top of mind for me when I think about it.
Oh, yeah. Totally great. That was exactly what I was hoping for. I always ask the same last question. What did I miss? What should I have asked but did not?
Oh, wow. Well, one question that we didn't talk a lot about today, what is the role of the district attorney if we are moving away from mass incarceration being the focus of the DA's office? And I've had a lot of really interesting conversations in the last couple of months talking to folks about how we can protect tenants and workers. And man, let me tell you, I'm slightly outside my lane talking about this, but the recent so-called stimulus package that is bundling trillions of dollars for banks just really fires me up. And I really think that the Manhattan DA's office needs to be focused on corporate accountability, focused to the extent that its resources allow on misbehavior by Wall Street. And so even as we move away from defaulting to jail and prison as the punishment for everybody who comes through the criminal court system, we should be thinking that if the role of the district attorney is to keep the public safe and promote justice in the community, what are other ways it can keep the community safe? And I think that means protecting tenants, protecting workers, holding corrupt business accountable.
All right. Well, as always, you know, it's great to talk to you and get to spend some time with you. I'm happy for you in your new in what you're doing now, but I kind of miss having you around in the activist world, although you're doing a different kind of activism now. And so
I'll find
really
an excuse to get out to Michigan. It's one of my favorite states. States.
Ah, well, you know, just let me know. We'll go get food. It'll be great. So thanks so much for doing this and taking the time.
Absolutely. Have a good one.
You too. And now my take. Well, to be honest, my take this week was the one that I gave above. My take was about decarceration, and hopefully that was enough for this week. I guess today what I want to do is wish you and your family peace. I know for many people this is a really challenging period, and for people who, like me, live alone, the isolation can at times be overwhelming. I hope everyone is using social media to compensate for social distancing. I hope everyone is staying in contact by phone and through Zoom meetings, and I hope everyone is being kind to each other. We had a very successful Day of Empathy event here in Michigan, and I was very hopeful about the potential for Zoom meetings to bring us all together in important and impactful ways, ways that might eventually help us circumvent some of the problems that people face when trying to get together at in-person events. But at the same time, we also have to always remember that not everybody has equal access to technology and to the internet. Despite all of our wealth and progress, we still face so many problems of equity in this country, and we need to make sure that everybody has access to these tools that could be great levelers for communication across the board. Most of all, I just hope everyone is okay. And a huge thanks to everybody who listens to the Decarceration Nation podcast. As I mentioned in the newsletter this week, I'm going to try to put out an episode every week for the duration of the crisis, just so everyone has more content in their lives. Much love to all of you. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/decarcerationnation. And I want to thank Brent Stevens for being a new supporter on Patreon, and thank Robert for helping me get out yet another episode of Decarceration Nation on Patreon, our companion series where Robert Alvarez asks me questions about important issues in mass incarceration. You can also support us by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or like us on Stitcher or Spotify. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me, to Robert Alvarez, who helps with the website, and to Kate Summers, who is helping with our Instagram and Facebook pages. Make sure and add us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and share our posts across all of your networks. Also, thanks to my employer, Safe and Just Michigan, for helping support the Decarceration Nation podcast. And thanks so much to you for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.